From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll talk with harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler. He started his career in vaudeville and went on to play with symphonies around the world. Also today, I'll speak with magician and juggler Penn Jillette. As half of the comedy magic team Penn and Teller, Penn has performed his often sadistic illusions on Saturday Night Live, Late Night with David Letterman, and Off-Broadway. Accordionist William Schimmel returns to play some tangos for us, and Ken Tucker has a review of the newly released home video featuring Ernest, who stars in a series of TV commercials, as well as the new film Ernest Goes to Camp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Adler, the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He began his musical career in vaudeville in 1928. He went on to play with musicians and performers like George Gershwin, Fred Astaire, Jack Benny, and Duke Ellington. But Adler is also at home in the concert hall performing music by Bach, Beethoven, and Liszt with the world's major symphonies. He's had works written for him by Ralph Vaughan Williams and Darius Milhaud. It's been said of Adler's musicianship that what he can't do on the harmonica can't be done. And Adler has said of his own work that he would like his epitaph to repeat what Billie Holiday once said to him, "You don't play that thing, you sing it." Larry Adler grew up in Baltimore in an Orthodox Russian-Jewish family. He now lives in London, where he moved in the early 50s after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. Larry Adler has written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. Larry Adler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of you. I may as well start off telling you right
now. What did I do?
Oh, you cleaned up the Billie Holiday story.
No, I know. I took out the expletive.
Yeah, well, you know, why can't we tell it this way? She heard me play with Duke Ellington, and then Duke took me over, and he said, "Larry, this is Billie Holiday." And I put out my hand to say, "How do you do?" And she says, "Man, you don't play that bleeping thing, you sing it." Now, you see, you can get it that way.
Okay, well, thanks. You shame me. Well, you have brought your harmonica with you. And before we talk about your life, I'd love for you to maybe play a pop song for us, and maybe I'll ask you to do some classical music.
All right, I'll tell you what, you name the song and I'll play it. Anything you like.
How about something by Rodgers and Hart or Gershwin? Give you your choice.
Do you know what chorus I'm about to go into?
No, is that the verse?
That's the verse.
Oh, and I was trying to figure out why I didn't recognize it.
All right, here comes the chorus.
Okay.
Thank you.
great. My Funny Valentine.
Now, see, nobody knows the verse. So nobody knows that that verse leads into that chorus.
That's great.
I don't think anybody knows the verse of anything.
You know, your tone is so different than the kind of tone that blues players have.
Mm-hmm.
You really have a different kind of vibrato.
Oh, yes, quite.
It's a completely different kind of tone.
Well, you must remember, my tone is the sum total, probably, of every musician I ever admired. Jascha Heifetz, Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, Andre Segovia, Django Reinhardt, Louis Armstrong, all of them, Bill Evans, all of them shape my playing, because the minute I admire a musician, something rubs off.
The way you tell it in your autobiography, you ran away from home when you were 14 in
yes.
the hopes of joining Borominovich and his harmonica band. And I think it's a pretty brave thing to run away when you're 14. But why did you have to run away to do it?
Well, I certainly couldn't have gotten permission from my mother and father. They wouldn't let me at the age of 14 go to New York. And I wanted to get away. And I had won this mouth organ competition. I was Baltimore's mouth organ champion. I read in the paper, Lawrence Cecil Adler, this is the man you're talking to, is the champion of Baltimore, and boy, I believed it. Went right to my head. And I was stage struck. I'd seen Al Jolson. I'd seen Eddie Cantor. I'd also heard Rachmaninoff. I'd seen Otto Klemperer conduct. I wanted to do what they did. And the best way was to get on the stage somehow. Now, I had about $50 my parents didn't know about because I sold Liberty magazines. So simply, without telling them, I went down to Union Station in Baltimore, got on a train. I had met a musician named Nat Brusiloff who'd made the great mistake of saying to me, if you ever come to New York, kid, look me up. He didn't know because I looked him up. And the poor man had to take care of me.
Well, you never made it into the Borominovich band.
Well, that was thanks to Borominovich because I auditioned for him and I played my guts out because this, to me, this was the epitome. This was God. And I played the Beethoven Minuet in G, which was the piece that I'd used to win the Baltimore Mouth Organ Competition. And when I finished playing, Mr. Minovich said, kid, you stink. I started to cry. I still can't imagine the savagery of talking to a young kid like that. And Bora had a dwarf in his band named Johnny Paleo. And Johnny said, Bora, why don't you let the kid come on with us for one show? And Minovich says, get him out of here. He stinks. Now, how does one go on from there? That is the thing that
baffled
me.
Well, how did you go on after that?
Well, I got on a streetcar. They had streetcars in those days. And I was going down to Penn Station, and I intended to go back to Baltimore because if Minovich didn't want me, what future was there? When the streetcar got to the Paramount Theater on Broadway, there was Rudy Valli's name in lights, and I remembered hearing him on the radio. And on impulse, I got off the streetcar, sneaked past the doorman, played to Valli, who put me on that night at his nightclub, where I flopped. It didn't mean a thing, but Valli had noticed me. He didn't say, kid, you stink. So on the strength of that minute encouragement, I stayed on. And within a week, I had a job on the Paramount circuit, including, by the way, playing in Philadelphia. And I played 44 weeks, doing 4, 5, and 6 shows a day. And that's how I began.
You were in vaudeville for quite a while. What,
oh, yes.
What was your act like, and what were some of the roles you had to take on in the act?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing, because when I first had this contract with Paramount, and I tried to do an act, well, I didn't have an act. I didn't know how to do an act. And it was the comedian in the show, it was a traveling road show, he thought of the idea of making me a local boy. So in 44 cities, I was a local boy. I was a local boy in Philadelphia, I was a local boy in Chicago, in Denver. And I used to get the most applause of anyone on the bill because this is our local boy. Give him a big hand. So the other act hated my guts, but there I was, local boy, making good. One thing that does puzzle me, in those days we did not use microphones and there were stage bands. How in hell could they hear me? A mouth organ has very little projection power. And yet when I finished playing, they applauded. So do you suppose, and this is one theory, did they listen better in those days? Without the amplification, they would have to listen to hear the sound, and maybe that is the explanation.
Maybe that's it. You were exposed to a lot of sex when you were pretty young.
Oh, still?
I don't think I've given it up, do you? No, but I'm thinking this 14 and 15-year-old in the middle of vaudeville, and people would take you to sex shows. And
only one, really. When we got to New Orleans, there was a big sexual exhibition, and the people on my bill and the people at the RKO Theater, we chipped in, and hired what was called a circus. And because I was only 14 or 15 years old, they didn't make me pay. That was my first freebie, a sexual circus. And I sat there and I watched these incredible things going on that I didn't know existed. And I think, in a way, it almost put me off sex.
Oh, really? Because it was so crass.
It was scary. It wasn't pleasurable at all. And also, I even as a kid, I think I was aware of people being exploited. I didn't like it. I've never liked striptease dancers, for example. I feel that they're being used and exploited. I didn't like that sex show. I don't like strippers. I don't like anything where people are made use of and they're not individuals anymore.
Well, did you feel exploited in vaudeville?
No, I wasn't exploited in my act.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? What kind of music did you play in the act?
I did Button Up Your Overcoat and an impression of Helen Kane singing I Want to Be Loved by You. That was my act, just those two numbers. Then later on, I got rid of the Helen Kane number and I played When Day Is Done. And you and I were talking before about this new record that's come out, Larry Adler Live at the Ballroom. I suggested they call it Larry Adler Dead in the Bathroom. I think it would be just as good a title. But on that record, I play When Day Is Done exactly as I played it when I was 14. And when I listened to it, I thought, hey, Adler, you really haven't improved a bit.
How did you break into pop music, an American popular song, playing Rodgers and Hart, meeting the Gershwins?
Well, mind you, look who was around in those days. Yeah. Not only Rodgers and Hart, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen. These people were like Schubert and Mendelssohn. They just wrote wonderful things, and you wanted to play them. Now, I was in Gus Edwards' act. It was a kiddie act. And while I was with him at the Palace, Paul Whiteman was playing at the Roxy with his own film, The King of Jazz. And I was dying to have Whiteman listen to me. So between my shows, I would go up to the Roxy and stand outside the stage door, and whoever came in or out, I'd blow the mouth organ in their face, hoping someone said, what a talented little boy this is. Well, finally someone did. Frankie Trumbauer, the very, very famous saxophone player, took me into Whiteman's dressing room. He says, Paul, listen to this kid. So I played Poet and Peasant. And when I finished playing it, Whiteman said, let me hear you play the Rhapsody in Blue. I was 15. I couldn't handle the Rhapsody in Blue. But I was a very arrogant, snotty little kid, and success has not changed me. I couldn't let him know that I didn't know Rhapsody in Blue and that it was too tough for me. So I said, I don't like Rhapsody in Blue. So he turns to a young man I hadn't noticed before, and he said, how do you like that, George? And that's how I met Gershwin.
Were you friends after that?
Well, that was the end of that, because right. I got out fast. But right. However, about 3 years later, a man named Jules Glenzer, who was the vice president of Cartier, he gave me a farewell party. I was going to England for the first time. This was 1934. And at this party, there was Johnny Green, there was Harold Arlen, there was Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, and with them all, I played a song of theirs. Now, I knew that sooner or later I was going to play something with George, and then our host, Jules Glenzer, said, Larry and George are going to play the Rhapsody in Blue. Well, by now, I'd heard it so many times, it was in my head, and I've got a very good ear. If it's in my head, I can play it. So George sat at the piano, I started to play, and when we finished playing, George got up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, the goddamn thing sounds as if I wrote it for you. Now, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because to me, the goddamn thing still does sound that way. And in my act now, I have a piano roll made by George Gershwin. That is on that record also. And I put scotch tape over the melody line. It sounds literally as if Gershwin is accompanying me. It's wonderful, and it's an eerie feeling.
You toured with Jack Benny for
yes.
a long time. Did you ever play music comedy with him? We all remember his attempts at being a violin virtuoso.
Well, we would do a duet together, and Jack would hit one note like this, then me on the mouth organ. Jack. Jack. All that one note. And it was very funny. And I probably learned as much from Jack Benny as one could learn from any individual performer because, first of all, he was an encyclopedia. And he gave me advice once in two words, which is the most valuable lesson I think you could ever learn in show business. And the two words are, don't press. And boy, that is a hard lesson to learn, because if you're playing for an audience that doesn't like you, the impulse is work harder, win them over. He says do just the opposite, relax, wait for them to find you.
Huh.
Oh, it takes you a long time to learn that.
We had some of the best timing in all of show business.
There is nothing like Jack's timing.
And one of the subtlest performers.
Yes. And also, he was one of the most considerate of people. See, I did 3 overseas tours with Jack Benny during World War II. And he encouraged me to do comedy. And if I got a bigger laugh than Jack, to him that just made the show better. There's many a comedian I know who, if you got a bigger laugh than they, you were out. You were fired. That was not Jack's way.
My guest is Larry Adler, harmonica virtuoso, and author of a new autobiography titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Larry Adler is my guest. He's the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He's performed with Fred Astaire, George Gershwin, Jack Benny, as well as with symphonies around the world. He moved to England after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. He's written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We should talk about your classical music playing. We've talked a little bit about vaudeville and pop. Very, very few people have played classical music on the harmonica. Why did you drift toward that?
I was always inclined toward the classical because the first musical impression I think I ever had was Sergei Rachmaninoff. An uncle took me to a recital of his at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore. And I believe that I can still remember the impression that that magnificent musician made on this little kid, 5 years old. And when I first played with the Baltimore Symphony, in the same building where I heard Rachmaninoff, I remember walking around the hall, seeing if I could remember where I was sitting to hear Rachmaninoff. But once having heard Rachmaninoff, I wanted to play classical music. And then I heard Yasha Heifetz. I heard Pablo Casals. Well, of course I wanted to do what they did. This was great music I was listening to. And it didn't occur to me to consider whether or not the instrument was right for it. If I wanted to do it, that was my medium. And I thought that I would be able to express myself on it, and I think I do.
It must have been hard getting accepted.
Oh, I don't think I'm accepted yet. I commissioned a work from Khachaturian, and he said to me, I'll go back to Russia, I will tell people about you, and they will not believe me. I said, well, why shouldn't they believe you? He said, because in Russia, small boys play their garmushka on street corners, and no one will believe that you can play classical music on the mouth organ. And that is still the general feeling. I mean, people, friends of mine, I've known them for years. Let's say they haven't heard me for 3 or 4 years. They hear me. Larry, it's amazing what you get out of that little thing. Well, that's the big cliche. I've been getting music out of that little thing for 59 professional years.
Can I ask you to play some classical music for us now?
You can ask me. Maybe I won't answer you.
What? Well, let's try.
What would you like?
Something by Bach?
By Bach, sure.
Thank you. beautiful.
Thank you.
Several composers have written works for you.
Yes.
And I'm sure those were composers who had never written for your instrument. What did you have to tell them about how to play harmonica and what a harmonica can or can't do?
I would lay out a diagram showing the limitations and capability. Like, for example, Vaughan Williams, I gave him a diagram showing which intervals, which chords were possible, which ones you couldn't play. And Vaughan Williams told me he pasted my instructions on his shaving mirror. And while he shaved, he would study what to write and what not to write. When the work was finished, there were a few things he'd written that were unplayable. For example, he had me playing C and F together. And you can't do that because you exhale C and you inhale F. And even with my two heads, I've never been able to figure out a way to do that. So I went down to Dorking, where he lived, after I'd received the manuscript. And I said, Mr. Vaughan Williams, please forgive me, but there are certain things in the work that do not lie naturally for the mouth organ. And he interrupted me. He says, so you don't like what I wrote, eh? Well, I wasn't saying that at all. But of course, I know now he was doing this for effect. He was, in his way, he was like Jack Benny. He says, well, if you don't like the way I wrote it, and he paused in that timing, he says, I'll change it. And if you like it the second time, I'll revise it once more. But if you don't like it the third time, I'm going to rescore the whole bloody thing for bass tuba.
Would it be imposing to ask you to play a line or two that one of the composers wrote for you?
Well, here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams. Now, he used the chord possibility of the mouth organ better than almost any other composer. And here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams Romance for mouth organ, piano, and strings. You see how he uses the chord possibilities.
Yeah.
Now, against that, he has a steady B double flat, and it just sounds wonderful to hear the bass note of the B double flat and those chords you just heard me play.
When you play with an orchestra, the orchestra has to tune to you. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the only man who ever gave me a hard time was your own ex-conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony, Eugene Ormandy. There was the Ford Symphony Hour, and Mr. Ormandy was the conductor, and I was going to be the soloist, playing the Vivaldi A minor concerto, the Vivaldi violin concerto. And I heard later he did not want to conduct for me at all, and he tried to get me canceled. But we each had a contract. Mine was as valid as his. Now, he rehearsed the orchestra and didn't let me come out until the last 10 minutes of rehearsal time, which was really awful. So I came out, and I gave my aid to the violinist, and Ormandy says, what is this? I said, well, you see, they have to tune to me. The mouth organ is the fixed reed. I cannot tune to them. He said, this is ridiculous. And I've never talked back to a conductor. I'm a coward anyway. But I said to him, Mr. Ormandy, I have played this work with this orchestra last year. If it embarrasses you to conduct it, I think we could do it without you.
Oh, I'm sure you got a great response to
that. Oh, the orchestra loved it.
Oh, dear. So what happened?
Well, he conducted it perfectly well for me, but he didn't talk to me after the concert.
I'm sure. Geez, you know, I would have liked to see you when you were 10 years old and you were a cantor.
Oh, I was so cute. You would have loved me. I was the most adorable little schmuck you have ever seen in your life.
Well, you were a 10-year-old, and for any listeners who don't know what a cantor is, the cantor is the person who conducts the singing part of the religious ceremony in a Jewish temple. Well, and I'm wondering if you did that when you were 10 for reasons of show business or religion.
No. What had happened was I was in a choir in Baltimore, and at the end of the high holidays, they gave each choir boy a gold watch, which I found very unsatisfactory. There was a choir on the synagogue across Druid Hill Park where they paid money. So I went over there and auditioned for them and got in their choir. Religion had nothing to do with it. Now, the cantor, his name was Adolf Weissgall, decided to create a children's synagogue and had me as the cantor. And I must admit that during my term as cantor, I was so religious. But then, during my term as cantor, I became 13. I was bar mitzvah, which meant I was a man, and I lost my job as cantor, and the religion began to fall away as of that moment.
There's no money or fame in it anymore.
I lost my power base.
Could you have played, do you think, a conventional instrument?
Well, I studied the piano, and I studied at the Peabody Conservatory, and I have a unique distinction, the sole student ever to have been expelled from Peabody. I had prepared a waltz by Grieg, and when I came up on the stage to play it, the principal of the school said, "And what are we going to play, my little man?" So I went to the piano and I played, "Yes, We Have No Bananas." And my parents got a letter, "Don't send him back." But I was fascinated by the piano. I would love to have been a concert pianist, but equally I know I would never have had the discipline that it requires to practice 6 to 8 hours a day to become a concert pianist. I'm a very good drawing room pianist, very good indeed, and my harmonies are good, my interpretation is fine, but I would never have become a concert pianist.
It takes discipline for the harmonica.
No, not as much, because, you see, there was no precedent. There was no Yasha Heifetz. Nobody could say, "Make like Rachmaninoff." There was no Rachmaninoff of the mouth organ. If there was, I was it.
I see what you mean. You returned to performing in the States. I think it was in the mid-70s after you left the United States because you were blacklisted. You couldn't get any jobs here. Did it take till the mid-70s until it was okay for you to perform here?
Not quite as bad as that. I came back in 1959, and I played at the Village Gate, a nightclub in New York. And I played a few others, such as the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and Mr. Kelly's in Chicago. But it didn't really catch on. These engagements were okay individually, but it didn't create a demand for me. Then I came back again in the 60s to do a film score in Hollywood, and Isaac Stern had introduced me to Saul Hurock, who said he would try to book a tour for me, and he could only get 3 concerts in about 6 months, and he said, "Larry, you've got to face facts. Concert committees are run by Republican ladies with long memories."
Right. So you're still living in England and you're going to stay there?
I still live there. I most certainly am going to stay there. I like it very much. I think England, with all its faults, is the most civilized country I know.
Well, I'm glad you're back to perform, if not to live. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed the
interview. Thanks, a pleasure to being here. My guest has been Larry Adler, the harmonica virtuoso, and he's written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. It's just been published by the Grove Press. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with writer Jim Carroll, who's author of the underground classic Basketball Diaries. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, magician and juggler Penn Jillette tells how Penn and Teller became one of the most popular magic and comedy acts around by subverting all the old cliches. The duo has had their own off-Broadway show and appeared on David Letterman and Saturday Night Live. Also today, accordion player William Schimmel returns to play some tangos for us. Ken Tucker reviews a new home video featuring Ernest, the star of the Hey Vern TV commercials, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Accordionist William Schimmel helped instigate the tango revival as a member of the ensemble The Tango Project. He also performed in the pit band for the Joseph Papp production of The Three Penny Opera. Tangos and the music of Kurt Weill are two of William Schimmel's passions. We invited him back to our studios to share these passions with us.
Most people view the tango as a dance. Well, of course it's a dance, but it's much more than that. It's a state of mind, a state of being, existential despair, loneliness, oppression. It can be best described as Argentine blues. Like the blues, tangos originated in the brothels of Argentina. And all the seamy sides of life were, in a sense, explained in the dance and music of the tango. And the people could feel, as they danced or sang a tango, that feeling of loneliness, of being misplaced, and most of all, of being just plain in the wrong place at the wrong time. One of the most famous examples is La Comparsita. And that's about a young gentleman who's in love with a girl of ill repute. And he wants to meet her at the ball to embrace her passionately. But he doesn't want to leave his sick, tubercular mother, and she keeps telling him, stay with me, stay with me, stay with me. But he can't resist his passions, and he runs off into the night to embrace the woman, only to return home later on that evening to find his mother dead. And so he will spend the rest of his life in holy celibacy. Now, La Comparsita is known mostly to all of us by Hernando's Hideaway, which is one of the tags in La Comparsita. So it's the most famous tango ever written, and here it is. What does Kurt Weill and the tango have in common? Well, they both share three basic characteristics. They speak directly to the heart, the gut, and the soul. Kurt Weill appreciated the irony of the tango. He appreciated that beautiful operatic lyricism that was possible, and to put underneath that the basic hard-edged irony of that incessant tango beat. Yeah, 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 almost punk. In Happy End, one of the primo examples of this treatment of the tango, he employs a beautiful singing lyrical line accompanied by a brittle, hard-edged accompaniment. And thanks to Kurt Weill and the tango, I'm able to explore my own Argentine blues in my own original three-penny accordion suite. Here, I capture the fragrances and essences of three-penny opera in an original work, very much like Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill did in exploring John Gay's Becker's Opera. And I'll leave you with this.
Accordionist William Schimmel is a founding member of the Tango Project. He's now finishing a collection of articles about tangos, the accordion, and his various sources of musical inspiration. It's titled Learning from Lawrence Welk. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Penn Jillette of the magic and comedy team of Penn and Teller. Teller is the short, silent magician. Penn is the tall, husky juggler and card shark who provides the narration, jokes, and verbal abuse. Audiences usually expect a team like this to swallow swords, eat fire, and pull rabbits out of hats. Penn and Teller can do that, but they almost always add a surprising twist, as David Letterman found out when they last appeared on his late-night TV show. Letterman asked Penn and Teller to really surprise him, and they did. After a familiar set of magic tricks, they set a black top hat on Letterman's desk. No surprise, until they lifted the hat, releasing several hundred live cockroaches, which swarmed across the desk. Penn and Teller also performed on Saturday Night Live and have made specials for PBS and Showtime. They recently ended a hit 2-year run off-Broadway. Penn describes their act as being for people who hate magic. I asked him what kind of magic he hated.
When people picture magic, they picture that kind of old guy in a tux pushing women in bad bikinis into boxes while playing, you know, Star Wars music or something. And there's a whole lot of people that would like what we do that wouldn't like the standard magic things. Was just the most important thing was to get that image of pushing women around out of people's minds so that we could do what we do.
Your specialty is juggling, and I wonder what first interested you in that.
Well, when you're about 12 or 13 years old and not involved in sports at all, it was a very good way to feel special. And so I just practiced a lot in high school. And actually, all the juggling skills that I have, I don't think I've gotten any better since I was 18, which I say with a little bit of pride. It means I've had other things to do since then.
You described some of the cliches in magic that you really grew to hate. What were some of the cliches in juggling that you wanted to avoid as a juggler?
Well, the cliches in juggling actually came in later. There's a whole feeling now where juggling is being tied in with what's called new vaudeville, which is something that I'm not very fond of. It has a real hippie connotation to it. And we aren't the kind of guys that live in buses. So we were kind of phasing out a little bit of the juggling, because there is such that feeling that we're trying to bring back some sort of golden age that never existed. People like the Karamazovs and Avner really have a good solid love of what they consider to be vaudeville, and Teller and I have either ignorance or a slight distaste for that same period.
How come?
It just seems like there's a feeling of putting old wine in new bottles. It's kind of like, well, we'll do the same stuff and it'll be quaint. And if there's one thing that Teller and I don't want to be, it's quaint.
You studied at Barnum and Bailey Clown College, as I recall. What kind of life is that supposed to prepare you for?
I have no idea. They're kind of running clowns through this whole thing, so they can just turn out essentially people who will dress up and walk around in parades. I went to Ringling Brothers when I was 18, 13, 14 years ago, and at that time it was very good for me, because I just got a lot of the skills that I didn't have before. I got a little bit of fire reading down and stuff like that. But as far as their actual theories on comedy, they are working places like Madison Square Garden, and I think there's a little bit of an emphasis on lowest common denominator, which is what I wasn't that interested in there.
Did you ever consider joining a circus or a carnival?
Well, when I went to Ringling Brothers, I was very, very interested in joining the circus, and by the time I got done with their training program, that interest kind of faded away. Because there's so little time in a three-hour show with hundreds of people in it, to just get an idea and put it across is very, very difficult. So working with a smaller group, all I have to fight with is Teller and not a corporation.
In your shows, you sometimes make it seem like magic and juggling are a lot of showmanship. And then after you've told the audience that, then you really make it come alive and make it seem truly magical.
Well, I really believe that there's a philosophy in magic that is in really all of magic. There's a level of condescension, the I can do something that you can't. And the problem with that theory is that when you're doing the show, you have people in your audience that can do heart surgery and fix motorcycles. I mean, program computers. And I think that in no other form of performance do people come out and have that kind of chip on their shoulder. So we take for granted that every single person in our audience, when they were 12 or 13 years old, read one magic book and learned one magic trick, and take that as a given. And I don't like that kind of Doug Henning coming out and saying, oh, just suspend all your disbelief and be children for a while. We don't want children in our audience. We want people to come with a real chip on their shoulder and knowing that what we're doing is swindling, because that's where the real fun of it is.
I'm sure a lot of magicians don't like you calling magic swindling and tricks. Do you get some negative reactions from some of the older magicians?
We try so hard to be bad boys, and we try so hard to make people like Harry Blackstone Jr. and Henning and Copperfield angry at us. But unfortunately, they're such professionals, and they're so good at what they do. I think they understand completely what it is we're trying to do. The only problems we've had, and we have had problems, has been with amateurs. Because they read the books and they take rules that are simply learning tools and act like they were moral rules.
Magicians and jugglers frequently wear capes and hats, and there's this whole costuming for that profession. And you guys started off performing, well, you would wear T-shirts and jeans, as I remember, mm-hmm. and Teller used to wear tights.
Yeah.
And now you both wear three-piece suits, which I can't think of anybody else who's ever worn three-piece suits in a magic kind of show. Well, how did you get the idea to dress that way?
There's a fascinating piece of history that ties in with this. When you picture the standard magician, you picture top hat and tails. Now, the reason you picture that is in the In the late 19th century, when magic was really flourishing in Europe, a magician got the brilliant idea that what he was going to do was to dress just like his audience, which at that time was top hat and tails. And then years went by, and all the technology of magic was built around how you can hide a bird inside the tails of a tailcoat. And magicians held on to that, and the basic idea behind it was completely lost. Teller and I decided that it would put more emphasis on us and what we were doing, and after all, the show is Penn and Teller, and it is unabashedly about us, if we took away anything people could hold on to. So we're wearing the clothes that are the closest, if not to our audience, then the closest to invisible. It makes people have to deal with us. They can't say, oh, that guy's wearing a sweater. That's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's wearing this kind of clothes. He's a Robin Williams kind of guy. He's wearing a leather jacket. He's a Bruce Springsteen kind of guy. You can't do that at all with a suit coat. And also the fact that I think that with our difference in sizes, the fact that we're dressed identical always makes me smile. It's kind of a monkey's thing happening there, you know. Mm.
In a cable special that you and Teller did, you ran your own magic store. That's how the uh-huh. story started. And I wonder if you still hang out in magic stores a lot, if that's still as much fun as it used to be.
We do go occasionally. I never hung out that much. Teller did very, very much in his youth. And what we had felt every time that a magic store was portrayed on television or in movies, it was always portrayed as a very mystical, wonderful Tinkerbell-type place. And the angle we wanted to give to it, which I think is the wonderful angle, is essentially a magic store is some old guy ripping off children. And the magic store had never been, I had never seen one in a movie or television that was dirty. But Invisible Thread is a little bit of a love letter to the cheesy, sleazy guys that really run those magic stores. And the nice thing was the magic store that Teller hung out in, which was the a magic store in New York that he hung out with when he was a kid, the man who owned it came to see Invisible Thread. Teller invited him to the screening, and afterwards he said, you know, that's just what I do. You guys really nailed it, you know? That Copperfield does this trick. I use that line all the time. It was just wonderful that he recognized what we were really trying to do. And so I think that I've unfortunately outgrown it a little bit, and also I can't go into a magic store and be taken anymore, and that's what I liked most about it. So I guess the answer is, in actuality, I don't really visit magic stores, but in my head, I do an awful lot. I have wonderful fond memories of that cheesiness.
That's Penn Jillette of the magic team of Penn and Teller. They're currently appearing at the Center Stage Theater in Baltimore. Besides magic, Penn loves rock and roll. He started a new record label that just released an album by Mo Tucker, the former drummer of one of Penn's all-time favorite bands, the Velvet Underground. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you covering today?
Well, the Supreme Court today threw out a Louisiana law that would have required the teaching of creationism in the public schools. We have a reaction from a Pentecostal preacher. Also, in the face of continuing violent protests in South Korea, the prime minister there spoke out for the first time, saying the government will take extraordinary measures, although the officials didn't say what exactly those measures would be.
I understand you'll also have something for us on the Paris Air Show.
Yes, we will. That's the biggest air show in the world. Over 1,400 exhibits, from nuts and bolts to fighter planes and Alice Furlow over champagne brunch, will survey the scene.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Occasionally, the commercials that interrupt TV programs become more popular than the programs themselves. A collection of Jim Varney TV commercials with Ernest and Vern are now available on video cassette. Our home video critic, Ken Tucker, has this review.
One of the most popular movies in theaters these days is the widely reviled Ernest Goes to Camp, starring Jim Varney as the ineffable rube Ernest P. Worrell. Varney has come to prominence with his Ernest character in a series of commercials for a wide variety of products, from soda pop to sour cream. In each one, Ernest goes over to his next-door neighbor, Vern, and badgers him with information about whatever product he's promoting. His catchphrase, the words, "know what I mean," said in a rush of Southern diction I won't even try to reproduce, can now be heard in schoolyards across America. At the climax of each commercial, the unbearably boorish Ernest is cosmically punished. A window falls on his fingers. He's pushed off the ladder he's climbed to annoy his neighbor. He sinks in a pool, leaving only bubbles on the surface of the water. None of this sounds especially funny when I describe it, but if you've ever seen an Ernest commercial, you know it's low-down fun, a real guilty pleasure. Varney's rubbery face and twanging patter are prime examples of the so-dumb-it's-witty aesthetic that operates in a lot of good popular culture. So what's this got to do with video cassettes? Well, there's a video cassette available of those commercials, and it captures the essence of Ernest. If you groan at the thought of 90 minutes of Ernest in a movie theater, you can chuckle over him in 30-second spots in the privacy of your own home. In this commercial, Ernest is pitching the accuracy of a Southern TV station's weather forecasting.
Hey, Vern, cooking out again? Are you crazy, man? Didn't you see Bill Evans' weather forecast on TV10's news? That Bill's got him a computer, Vernon. The man is wired for weather. Didn't you hear Bill say that it was going to start raining any second? We are talking pinpoint, Vernon. Next time, talk to your buddy Ernest first. Know what I mean? Leave him ribs about ready, Vern. Looks like it might rain.
I don't want to read too much into the importance of being earnest, and half the fun is seeing Jim Varney turn his face into an artfully controlled exaggeration of a fool. Ernest P. Worrell is the most entertaining commercial character since Stan Freberg dripped sarcasm over the airwaves. As for other new video cassette releases, after you watch the Ernest commercials, you'll probably feel guilty enough to go upscale, but go easy on yourself. Try some high-class entertainment with pizzazz, such as A Room with a View, a fizzy comedy of manners featuring Daniel Day-Lewis. On the other hand, if you want to sink even deeper into the cultural mire than Ernest would ever go, there's Sid and Nancy, the story of punk rocker Sid Vicious, portrayed in a heroically slimy manner by Gary Oldman.
Ernest and Vern's Greatest TV Hits is available on a video cassette that also includes Hey Vern, It's My Family album comedy special. Video reviewer Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Roger Bruins, who writes about the vanishing world of the hobos. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review Reflections in Blue, the new album by Sun Ra and his orchestra. And television critic David Bianculli will preview CBS Summer Playhouse. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Brutman. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.